I'm Mike Collins. Mecklenburg voters are deciding the Arts and Science Council's request for a quarter-cent sales tax increase to help shore up the arts and culture sector.
Organizations are in crisis and they might be lost.
If approved, there would be new funding for the arts and money for parks and greenways and schools. But some question if a sales tax hike should be for other needs.
To me, the big community problem is affordable housing.
We'll hear from both sides in a Charlotte Talks Forum Monday, October 28th at 7 p.m. at the McGlowan Theater. Registration and details at WFAE.org. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Welcome to Charlotte Talks. I'm David Borax, in for Mike Collins. Automobiles long ago displaced trains as the default mode of transportation in the U.S., but if you talk to people who've traveled overseas recently, some of their biggest impressions are the trains. In places like Europe and Asia, they're an important part of the transportation system. National governments have strong rail policies and a will to pay for trains. And in some countries, there's competition among public and private operators, too. They're an easy and reliable way to get from here to there. Today on Charlotte Talks, we'll hear from experts about the status of rail in the U.S., and more specifically, planning for a high-speed rail line from Atlanta to Charlotte. Someday, that trip could take only 2 or 2.5 hours. My guests are Jeff Davis, senior fellow at the Eno Center for Transportation in Washington. He's a longtime consultant and expert on long-term trends in transportation funding and policy. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Andy Kuntz is with us. He's president and CEO of the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association, also in Washington. It promotes the idea of high-speed rail. Thanks for joining us, Andy.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from the Georgia Department of Transportation, we have two people. Carol Comer is the Intermodal Division Director, and Casey Mertz is Planning Manager for Financial and for Rail and Transit at the Georgia DOT. Welcome, Carol and Casey.
Good morning.
The Georgia Department of Transportation is actually in the middle of planning for the proposed Charlotte to Atlanta high-speed rail line, along with the future of this. There's a public open house tomorrow night in Charlotte. And Casey, I wanted to start out with you. What's the purpose of the meeting tomorrow night in Charlotte?
Thanks. So the purpose of the meeting tomorrow night in Charlotte is to invite the public to review our materials and look at the three corridor alternatives that we've been studying and provide an opportunity for them to leave us a comment and ask questions about the project. So the step that we're at right now, the Federal Rail Administration and Georgia DOT, we've completed a draft Tier 1 environmental impact statement. And what that is it's a very early foundational step in the planning and environmental review process for potential passenger rail. So for projects of this magnitude and complexity, the federal government allows us states to complete smaller bite-sized pieces of the environmental process. So this Tier 1 study is very preliminary, and it does three things. It establishes a need statement for the project, and it identifies and evaluates a range of corridor alternatives that could satisfy passenger travel, and it includes coordination with other agencies and the general public to get feedback on the project. And so that piece is what's important for our public meeting tonight. The public can provide their comments in person and or in writing at our meeting, or they can go to our website at dot.ga.gov and go to Atlanta, Charlotte, and fill out an online comment form there as well.
So this is one of a series of meetings, right? Where else have you had them, and what other agencies are you working with besides the Federal Rail Administration?
Correct. So this is a series of three meetings. Last night, we held one here in Atlanta at Georgia DOT's office in downtown Atlanta. Tonight, we're going to be in Greenville, South Carolina, and tomorrow night, we'll be in Charlotte. And the meeting addresses and times for all of those meetings are on our website at dot.ga.gov, but they're all 5:30 to 8 p.m.
Okay.
The other agencies we've coordinated with, so Georgia DOT and the Federal Railroad Administration, we're the lead agencies, so we're taking kind of ownership of developing the documentation for this project. But we have a number of participating agencies who have been really critical in this process and helping craft this document and guide the direction of it. North Carolina DOT and South Carolina DOTs have been really critical partners, and they've been fantastic to work with. They're also helping us put on these meetings in Greenville and Charlotte this week. There are a number of municipalities and cities and regional planning bodies that are within this project area. They've also been really great participating partners, providing us information on other rail, transit, and highway projects and airport projects in their communities. And they've also been able to help explain how this project could support economic development and satisfy the demand for travel in their communities as well.
I want to spend some time later in the show getting into the details of this project, but big picture, what is the headline on this? Can you give us an overview, and where are we in the planning?
So like I said, the Tier 1 environmental study is a very preliminary, foundational step. What would happen after we finish our comment period is GDOT and the FRA will review all the comments and respond to them. We'll incorporate all of the feedback that we've gotten into a final environmental impact statement, and we'll publish that for the public to view. The next steps for this are a little bit less certain, so it's important to know that funding and a timeline for next steps have not been identified yet. GDOT has not identified funds for a future environmental study that would pick up where this one leaves off. But the outcome of this Tier 1 environmental impact statement will be to select one of these three corridor alternatives that we're providing, that we're displaying for the public to view, that could move forward for a potential Tier 2 environmental study.
All right. And just to remind our listeners, that meeting is an informal drop-in Thursday night from 5:30 to 8. It's at the Metrolinia Transportation Management Center on Tipton Drive in Charlotte, and you can get more information at WFAE.org. I want to talk more specifically about the project in a bit, but I want to get a little context here. Among at least some Americans, there's a vision of building or rebuilding a national passenger rail system, including the kind of high-speed rail we see in other countries. Here's former President Barack Obama in 2009.
Imagine boarding a train in the center of a city. No racing to an airport and across a terminal, no delays, no sitting on the tarmac, no lost luggage, no taking off your shoes. Imagine whisking through towns at speeds over 100 miles an hour, walking only a few steps to public transportation, and ending up just blocks from your destination. Imagine what a great project that would be to rebuild America.
Andy Kuntz, I want to turn to you. That's an attractive sounding vision. In fact, it sounds exactly like my trip this summer through Italy and France with my family. It's a reality there. What's the holdup here in the U.S.?
First off, I'd like to say we appreciate President Obama for actually making that case, and he made it over and over and over again. The holdup is we don't have the leadership to do this. We're not putting the funding into it. We're putting all our money in basically roads and aviation and ignoring rail as a form of transportation, and that's been our more or less our federal policy for decades, 50, 60 years.
We've been putting a lot of money, well, back from the 50s, we put billions of dollars into the interstate highways.
Trillions.
Trillions, okay. And the system is now at a point where we need to put another multi-trillion dollars into fixing it up. But the focus has been totally on roads. The rail lines have still been here. The corridors are still here. I think it's been years that we've been looking at the idea of expanding our rail system. But the funding doesn't seem to be there, as you say. Jeff Davis, as someone who studies long-term rail planning, first, how do we in the U.S. define high-speed rail? I mean, how fast are we talking about?
What goes by the appellation of high-speed rail in the U.S. is not what other nations consider high-speed rail. There are a couple of different tiers of high-speed rail the Obama administration established, from around 100 that can start around 110 miles an hour, whereas the Shinkansen, the Japanese bullet train, can get over 220. So the top speeds under consideration for the Charlotte to Atlanta corridor, there's six different scenarios, three corridors, and then each one, whether it's going to be diesel or electric. And those top speeds range from 79 miles an hour, which is current, to 220, but most of the scenarios are somewhere in the 110 to 125.
And you mentioned the options would be diesel or electric, and obviously there are other considerations that we're looking at, including climate change and the imperative to reduce diesel emissions. The diesel trains, as I understand it, are the slower version, is that right?
Yeah, the top speed, because that's one locomotive, maybe two, pulling a bunch of passenger cars, whereas in general on the electric cars, you can have each car have motors built into it. So the top speeds and the acceleration and deceleration are generally faster on the electrified rail systems.
Right. Well, those trains I was taking... Oh, go ahead, Andy.
Around the world, the minimum speed for high speed, to be considered high speed, is 186 miles an hour. That's basically equates to 300 kilometers an hour. That's pretty much their minimum cutoff.
Mm-hmm. Actually, when you're on those trains in Europe, they have a video screen that tells you how fast you're going, and it flashes when they get up to 300 kilometers an hour, about 180. So
it only takes them about 5 minutes to get up to that speed.
That's right. As soon as you get out of town. Anyway, so and I've also taken high-speed trains in China and Taiwan, and they are equivalent to the ones in Europe as far as speeds go. Again, it's hard to come back from these places and not wonder, why can't we have this here? Andy, you know, what is the status of high-speed rail in the U.S. right now? I mean, we're looking at one project here today, but as far as nationwide goes, do we have any projects that are moving along?
We do, actually, and the problem is there's not been federal leadership. So what's happened is that certain states, like this in today's discussion, the states are taking the lead. And right now, the first one in line is California. They have over 119 miles currently under construction. And the whole thing is going to be a 220-mile-an-hour standard. So fully electric, it's going to be fully powered by renewable energy, and it's going to hit all the big cities and a number of smaller cities along the way.
And
that's the one that's under construction. We have one moving forward in Texas, a privately led project. That'll be a 200-mile-an-hour system. And then also we have a conference coming up in 2 weeks in Seattle where that one is brewing up, 220-mile-an-hour system as well between Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver, British Columbia.
So relatively speaking, the Atlanta-Charlotte segment that we're talking about is not as far along as those are.
No, it's in the earlier stages. And basically what the lady from the DOT outlined is the first steps you do are some analysis of what are the options. And then they begin to hone in on one, and then you begin to start doing more detailed engineering and more hearings. And then once you get past that, you start actually looking at purchasing land. I mean, there's a lot of steps in this, and it's a lot of work, but that's what California has been going through. They're simultaneously getting the approvals while they're also still buying land for further corridors as they keep expanding. And then at the same time, they have several of the earlier pieces under construction. So it's like a continuous process of a pipeline.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little while ago about the interstate highway system getting started, and 90% of that has been paid for by the federal government and the rest by the states. Is it fair to compare what's going on with high-speed rail right now to the origins of the interstate highway system?
Absolutely. I mean, and there's no reason why the federal government shouldn't be paying 90% of the high-speed rail systems as well.
Well, there's the question.
One of the problems is that you have to define the pronoun. What do you mean, we? Because the federal government, in the case of the highway system, 100% of those costs from 1956 till about 10 years ago were paid for by excise taxes on motorists and truckers. It was a sort of self-perpetuating system, users paying for system benefits. No one is seriously proposing to put excise taxes on railroad passengers in order to pay for this. So in the absence of a dedicated user-based revenue source, like airports and air traffic control have, like highways had until 10 years ago, it's a lot harder to get massive amounts of spending off the ground when those general revenue appropriations have to compete with education and veterans and other pressing needs.
So it sounds like that's one of the major holdups here, is that we need to find a dedicated revenue stream.
Yes. I mean, the federal government has never in the history of this country been in the business of writing checks to subsidize railroad development, except for that one-year period in the Obama administration early on when they wrote about $10.1 billion in checks, and then the Republicans turned off the faucet when they took over. Mm-hmm. The Transcontinental Railroad was paid for by giving away land that we bought from Napoleon Bonaparte at 3 cents an acre.
Okay, we're going to take a break here. We need to come back and talk more about high-speed rail. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm David Borak, sitting in today for Mike Collins, and we're talking about planning for a high-speed rail line between Charlotte and Atlanta. And just a reminder, there's a public open house Thursday night on that project in Charlotte. You can find out more at WFAE.org. My guests this morning are Jeff Davis of the Eno Center for Transportation in Washington, Andy Kuntz, CEO of the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association, and Carol Comer and Casey Mertz of the Georgia Department of Transportation. And Jeff, I wanted to let you finish your thought right before the break there. You were talking about the need to provide funding and land for these rail lines. You want to continue what you were saying there?
Just that the process by which the federal government gave away land and did some bond guarantees to private companies to build the Transcontinental Railroad in the 1860s and 70s was a one-off that's not really repeatable today, because in the Charlotte to Atlanta corridor, for example, all the government doesn't own that land anymore. That's owned by private citizens. It'll have to be condemned through right-of-way, and that gets expensive, as we've seen in the current California experiment, where the cheapest part of the high-speed rail system is costing about $104 million a mile, and that doesn't include buying trains to run on it.
Well, let me ask you about that. How do the costs of rail compare to the costs of building highways these days?
In general, the highways are going to be cheaper for the most part, just because the electric catenary for high-speed rail in particular. But but the problem is the highways are already there. Building a green field throughout a new corridor where there's no right-of-way currently is generally the most expensive, just because of right-of-way acquisition. However, in this situation, the corridor along I-85 right-of-way would actually be more expensive than Greenfield because of the amount to which real estate has been built up around 85 over the recent decades.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the arguments against rail is that nobody uses it or will use it. And I did read a survey from a few years back that said that 63% of people surveyed said they're likely to use high-speed rail if it were available. And that number was higher among younger people, 71% among those 18 to 44. Andy, is that a good argument that why we should not build these?
Well, I mean, every high-speed rail system that's built in the world, 20-something nations have all invested this kind of money, and they've all gotten enormous ridership. There's not a single one that hasn't been transformative.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I want to point out, what was said earlier, Jeff mentioned that highways were all built on user fees. That's a complete fallacy, because there has to be a highway first before the first user fee is generated. So the highways were basically paid for, the land and the highway construction, 90% by the federal government, and continue to subsidize them today for maintenance and highway patrol and all the other services.
So highways, the maintenance at least these days, is paid for by those user fees. This is a curiosity, but how do they pay for trains in other countries?
So basically, a high-speed rail system, they actually make a profit once they're up and running. So basically, in all the nations that have them, the government paid to build them, and then from the day they open, the system starts paying back money to the government, because they are such an efficient system that they actually turn billions of dollars in profit. And so you can look at the Japanese company, for example. They're making two-thirds of their profits are off their real estate holdings at the stations, and the other third is off the train revenues. So there's been studies from the UK that more or less say that systems that are electric and 150 miles an hour or faster tend to be profitable. Systems that are slower than that, and most of them, when they're slower than that, are diesel, they tend to have to be subsidized forever. That's kind of a general guideline.
So there's an argument for going electric, I guess.
And faster.
When you say profit, are you talking about they're actually paying off the money that was spent to build this, or as an operating entity?
No, both. They actually create enough excess money to cover, more than cover, operations and maintenance. So there's a profit there for the company running it. And then out of those profits, they can make payments back to the original construction. Now, to pay down these are expensive projects to build. To pay down all the way down to zero may take 20, 30 years. But the day they open, they're immediately positive cash flow generators.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say, while the federal government is not generally in the business of providing grants to build new high-speed rail systems, there is a huge fund of federal loans and loan guarantees that can be made to, at the lowest possible interest rates, that can be made to construct some of these. That's why one of the Texas project that's out there on the horizon may be trying to anticipate a large multi-billion dollar federal loan. And there's tens of billions of dollars in unused loan authority that can be made, which if the taxpayers of North and South Carolina and Georgia decide to collectively build a corridor like this, they could access.
And I'm hearing Andy say that there's a business case for that this would pay off those loans.
We'll see. It hasn't been done in this country yet. But rail policy in this country is largely by accident. We were proactive with building having the Transcontinental Railroad built, and ever since then, we've been reactive with the bankruptcies of the Northeastern Railroads in the late 1960s, the federal government inheriting a large mess and then creating Amtrak out of that.
So is there a role for the private sector in railroads here in the U.S.? You know, when you travel, we were in France, we needed to go to Amsterdam, and we took the Thialys train, which is a private one, I believe, from Paris to Amsterdam. You see those in Italy as well. And is there a role for private in the U.S.?
Well, Florida, there already is a private one up and running. I mean, the Bright Line, it's not high speed, but it's medium speed. That's all being built by private sector. And see, what they're doing is the same as what I mentioned earlier, the Japanese. They're leveraging the real estate values that are created when you put a high-speed train in and a high-speed station. You can basically make a lot of money off the real estate right away to fund the upstart of the rail system. And then once you get a couple of cities in place and a couple real estate development, the whole thing begins to pay off. That's why Fortress is actually investing in heavily now. They're starting the Vegas project right now. They've already got people set up there and are beginning to build that.
You talked about the Florida project, Bright Line, and one of the partners in that is Richard Branson, the British investor whose Virgin Group is involved there. And they were discussing going public with an IPO earlier this year on the stock market. And in their IPO filing, they mentioned Charlotte to Atlanta as a possible investment target for them. They have since put that IPO on hold, but could he be a possible partner here in this area?
Most definitely. I mean, they're looking at the Texas corridor. They're looking at Chicago. They said what Wes Edens, who's their chairman, said is that we're looking at corridors all over the country where it's too long to drive and too short to fly. That's like their sweet spot. It's like up to 500-mile trips. It makes sense in numerous corridors in this country.
That's very true. The sweet spot is between about 225 to 500 miles of city pair corridors that would actually make sense for real high-speed rail. Now, the problem is that Charlotte to Atlanta is kind of on the short side of that. The air distance is 226 miles. I believe the different corridors are between 250, 275 on rail miles. But in terms of you're trying to take market share from both people who drive and people who fly. And you're not going to get that really from Charlotte to Atlanta. The Department of Transportation says that it only averaged in the fourth quarter of last year 462 one-way passengers between Charlotte and Atlanta, whereas the corridor of similar distance between LA to Vegas has about 6,400 passengers a day that are already flying. So in terms of the market share you're going to capture, you're trying to take more from driving than from flying in the case of a Charlotte to Atlanta city pair.
Well, back to that.
These also start changing patterns, though. Keep this in mind. Once you put a piece in and you start concentrating development near the stations, then patterns start changing. People's living patterns change, employment patterns change, and then also this system is part of a longer corridor that's going to keep on going further north and connect into the Northeast Corridor. So when you begin to look at the Charlotte corridor as part of a bigger, longer corridor, then you begin to see how this thing starts 2 + 2 starts equaling 6 once you've connected the 3 more cities and the longer distances are now part of, becomes a network.
Very true. But is it proper to ask the people of North, South Carolina and Georgia to put their money on the line with a project that'll make a lot more sense if other states someday provide the connectivity on either side, but if they don't, the business case for the project makes less sense?
Well, they make sense right away, standalone. But then what I'm saying is they make more sense as more and more pieces are added into the network. I mean, you saw this in Europe. They built a line from Paris to Lyon. That's the only line that existed in all of Europe. And that made sense all by itself. And then now that's part of a gigantic network that spans 8 nations.
Jeff, let me ask you about, you mentioned the Southeast Corridor. The Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor has been something that the U.S. has been in the planning stages on forever, it seems. This piece from Charlotte to Atlanta is an add-on to the original idea for that, which was Charlotte to Washington, D.C. So the question right now is, what happened to Charlotte to Washington?
It's slow going getting rail, passenger rail, south of Richmond down to the Charlotte area. All the planning for all these corridors was put out, the planning money was put out by the Obama administration in 2009 and 2010, and it's taken this long to actually see the results there. But in many instances, the cheapest way to go would be to use the existing freight railroad right-of-way, which was laid out starting in the 1840s. And, you know, it sounds basic to say, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. And these original 1840s, 50s, and 60s right-of-way designs were kind of curvy because they didn't have the technology then necessarily to take down hills or fill valleys to get through there. So, and the problem is that real estate has been built up around there, especially, this is the problem with getting better high-speed rail between D.C. and Boston, is that the old routes are so curvy and the real estate surrounding them would be so expensive to condemn and use for straightening out.
Well, let's get back to that Charlotte-Atlanta line and take a closer look right there. The idea of a Charlotte to Atlanta high-speed rail route goes back to at least 1992. There was an article in the Charlotte Observer in 2002 that started this way. North Carolina and Virginia are a step closer to starting high-speed train service from Washington, D.C. to Charlotte by 2010. By 2010. So obviously they were off by a few decades there. But turning again to you folks at the Georgia DOT, Carol, you know, big picture here, is this just a pipe dream or a dream? Is this something that we're in the process of solving?
Well, I think from the department's perspective, taking this step to complete the Tier 1 environmental impact statement, you know, really lays the foundation for, hopefully in improving and enhancing additional mobility options. I think one of the things from a Department of Transportation's perspective is it takes a network of transportation options, whether it's roads, rails, runways, rivers. We have to have all the pieces there. And so as far as rail is concerned, you know, this is a step to help us determine the feasibility of the project. And as you mentioned earlier, or I don't know if it's been mentioned yet, but we currently don't have funding identified. You know, certainly the Tier 1 study is conducted at a very high level as far as cost estimates. And so, but we don't have funding identified. So certainly trying to look for private investment would most likely, be an option to help make this project a reality. But again, from the department's perspective, you know, determining the feasibility and putting the foundation there to be built upon, we feel like it. You know, we're very satisfied that we've done that.
So folks who come to comment at the meeting or who want to comment in other ways about the environmental impact statement, they do have some information that's available. And I wondered if you could walk us through what the corridors are. There are 3 corridors under consideration. Can you describe those for us and the costs and that sort of thing?
Yeah, we certainly can. And actually, I'm going to ask Casey Mertz, who is actually our project manager for this project for the department, to do that.
Yes. Hi. Thanks, Carol. We do have three corridors that are under consideration that have been studied in this Tier 1 environmental study. The first corridor is we're calling the Southern Crescent, and that follows existing freight railroad, which is the same railroad that Amtrak service uses today. So this study looks at ways to improve the frequencies and speed along that existing route, and we're assuming that it could serve the same station cities that the Amtrak service serves today. The second option we're looking at is the I-85 corridor, and that follows existing interstate right-of-way through Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina, would likely be parallel to the existing highway. In some places, it would have to be on structures due to the developed nature of areas near the interstate. And then third, we have a greenfield corridor, and the greenfield basically follows a new route that's not on an existing railroad or highway. The greenfield has the highest speed potential because you can have the more flexibility to design the curves and grades in a way that accommodates higher speed. So these are the three high-level corridors we're looking at in the Tier 1. All of these three options vary, of course, in travel time and speeds and potential capital and operating costs. Often, as you would assume, cost and speed are a trade-off, so the options that use existing infrastructure might have lower costs, capital costs, but they might not be able to reach as high of speeds as the other options. What we'll do is we'll, in this Tier 1 step, we're selecting these high-level, like generally or broadly defined corridors, and then a Tier 2 study will drill down further with the selected corridor alternative and choose a specific alignment. So the station locations that we that you see out on our meeting materials and at the public meetings right now, these are all very early assumptions as to where stations might be. They're kind of located where we have good population centers and good local transit connections and airport connections, but those would all be verified and reevaluated during a future Tier 2.
Well, let me drill down a little more, Casey, on some of the other elements that you described. One of those that everybody's curious about is how long it will take to get from Charlotte to Atlanta or vice versa with these different alternatives. Which one is the fastest and which one, what are the other ones?
Sure. So the fastest, based on the preliminary performance analysis that we've done, is the Greenfield. And it is the fastest because, as I mentioned earlier, you have more flexibility in designing a route that accommodates the higher speeds, gentler curves, gentler grade differences. There's also greater distances between the stations. So it allows the speed to kind of the train to carry its speed for longer distances. The second would be the I-85.
So let me just back up a minute. That would be an if you used an electric, which would be the fastest alternative, that would be a little over 2 hours. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, a little over 2 hours.
Okay, and let's come back just a minute to this. It's time for us to take a break again. We'll be right back with more in just a minute on Charlotte Talks 90.7 WFAE. Welcome back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm David Borak, sitting in for Mike Collins. We're taking a look today at high-speed rail in the U.S., including a line proposed between Charlotte and Atlanta. Our guests are Jeff Davis of the Eno Center for Transportation, Andy Kuntz of the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association, Carol Comer, and Casey Mertz of the Georgia Department of Transportation. And Casey, we were walking through some of the details of the Atlanta-Georgia route there, and we just were talking about the Greenfield Corridor alternative, which would be the fastest of the three because it's not encumbered by having to go on existing tracks, and it can have more room between stations, and it could get up to 220 miles an hour with an electric train and take a little over 2 hours. What about the I-85 corridor alternative?
Yeah, the I-85 corridor alternative is quite comparable to the Greenfield. Its travel time is a little bit longer. We're looking at it 2.5 hours, between 2.5 hours and 3 hours. So that's, of course, again, limited. You're a little bit more limited with your speed just because the design of our highways isn't necessarily comparable with ideal design for high-speed rail. So we have different curvatures and grade differences on the interstate right-of-way. But if you use electric train technology for the I-85 corridor, you can get very comparable travel time with the Greenfield.
And the Southern Crescent, what about
that Southern one? The Southern Crescent, based on our analysis, we think it's about 4.5 to 5.5 hours. So this is a much longer travel time. And that's mainly because, again, we're assuming the use of existing freight rail right-of-way. So that's in a lot of places that's sharing trackage with freight trains. So there's you get less speed and reliability with that. Also, we're assuming on that corridor that we would be sticking with diesel technology versus the option of upgrading to faster electric technology with the other two corridors.
And what about the costs of these? I think the estimates are all over the place because they're all so different. But if you could just tick off the different alternatives.
Yeah. The Southern Crescent has the least capital cost, and that's around $2 billion. The I-85 has the greatest capital cost, and there's a range between $13 and $15 billion. And the Greenfield corridor is in the range of $6 to $8 billion. And so a lot of people wonder, why is the 85 corridor more expensive than the Greenfield corridor on brand new right-of-way? And that's because on the 85 corridor, there are many places where we're constrained between the highway and development that has occurred over the years. So there are a lot of places where new structures would have to be built in order to accommodate new passenger rail. And then also in many places, you would have to accommodate the existing interstate interchanges with other roadways. So there's a lot of new bridges and other design and engineering work that would have to take place to make that 85 corridor work.
What factors will determine your choice of a corridor here?
Yeah, so FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, and us at GDOT will work with our partners in North Carolina and South Carolina after the public comment period closes to review the comments and see what people have to say in terms of the corridors they support. We'll take that feedback along with all of the technical analysis that's in our environmental study documentation online right now. So we'll look at the feedback, what corridors people support, as well as how well they perform against each other and what types of environmental impacts they might have.
And Carol or Casey, what have we heard at previous meetings in Greenville and Atlanta so far?
We've gotten a lot of feedback. A lot of it has been really supportive for the project. We've heard from a lot of different individuals providing their support for one of the three corridor options. That's the most common type of feedback we get is telling us which option they support the most. We've also heard from a lot of municipalities and planning agencies in our project area in support for the project passing through their community due to economic development benefits that they think their community would reap from this project.
We've got a couple of comments on social media here. Kyle on Twitter says, it has to be electric. If not, then it's a waste of time. Trains are a no-brainer, but we have to do it right. And then Russ sent us an email. Comparing rail in Europe to the U.S. is not comparable at all. The cost of auto ownership and use in Europe is many times the cost of U.S. ownership. Population density in Europe also improves the efficiency and access to rail terminals. So, again, an argument against doing rail. Any of our guests care to comment on those thoughts from our listeners?
It's not that... That observation about Europe is partly true, but the other thing about Europe is that they made a decision as a society to move most of their freight via trucks and via their much more developed systems of waterways and canals rather than on rails. So, you know, if you wanted to try to turn America into Europe rail-wise, you'd need a lot more trucks on the road carrying bulk goods. So there's a bit of a trade-off there, and the population density thing is largely accurate. But again, it can make sense in certain city pairs in the United States to have dedicated true electric high-speed rail, but you've just got to make sure that the city pair you're connecting makes sense on its own, even if your neighboring states never come along and allow you connectivity beyond that.
I think that part about the trucks is not correct. California, what they're building is going to have nothing to do with trucks. If anything...
No, I'm, I was talking about Europe. In Europe, you said in America,
that's what's going to happen. That if we build high-speed rail, we're going to have a ton more trucks on the road.
If you try to magically convert overnight the American system to a European system, you'd have a lot more trucks on the
road.
We're
not talking about putting trains on the freight railroads. That's where one of the corridors
is actually in this Charlotte to Atlanta instance, putting the train.
Okay, that's what the one reason why it's not a good idea. You're making the case of why we should invest in true high speed rail.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if the cost estimates of these three are correct, the Greenfield certainly appears to be the no brainer. I suspect the cost estimate's low because it's between $23 and $31 million a mile, whereas the current Greenfield California project between Fresno and Bakersfield is north of $100 million a mile without trains. But if you can keep the costs low, then certainly the Greenfield electrified would be the best way to go.
And on the trains I've taken in Shanghai and Taiwan, in both of those cases, they've chosen Greenfield routes just because they wanted new modern tracks that can handle higher speeds and all of that. And I think that where it's possible in the U.S., we probably will be looking at, right?
Every high-speed rail system in the world is on Greenfield sites. That's the only way you can get straightaways and exclusive dedicated track where you can go those kinds of speeds.
We're talking about a proposal here on the East Coast, the Southeast Corridor and then the Northeast Corridor. But is this easier to do in other places where there are more wide-open spaces?
Well, usually what we looked at was there's the cheapest per mile is about $20 million per mile, and that's what the Tampa to Orlando is set to cost. And it's because it's wide open land, it's already a highway median, there's no mountains to drill through, there's no communities there backing up to it. So that would be the low end, the easiest. The high end, most complex, would be tunneling under a city or tunneling through a 30-mile tunnel through a mountain. And those could be up in the hundreds of millions per mile. And so what you end up with is every rail project has some of each of those. It has a few miles in the city. It has a bunch of miles in the rural. It might have a tunnel. So you end up with widely varying costs per mile to get the full system built because you're dealing with different types of geography and terrain.
I want to zoom a little farther back out to the whole country. Andy, what is your vision for a high-speed rail network nationwide, and what would it cost, and when might we be able to do it by?
When we launched our association in 2009, we also launched a national map, and it was based on our transcontinental railroad, our interstate highway system, and also on at that time what Europe had built into a multinational network. And so we show it's we actually have it on our website. It's a HSR map. It's called. It shows a 17,000-mile system built in phases. We starting in the dense corridors where the big cities are, where the ones that make the most sense, and then little by little building out the whole country, just like we did our highway system, connecting up the whole country. Our rough estimate for that was about $600 billion for the entire system. And when we saw what China actually built, and the amount of money they spent, the same in Spain and a few other places, those numbers are pretty right on. In fact, even the UK High Speed 2 is almost the same cost per mile as the California system.
And so Jeff, is that something that you could see coming into being?
In terms of, you know, $600 billion, which is probably on the low end of the cost estimate, I'm not seeing the federal government stepping up to pay any particularly large share of that anytime soon. There's not an appetite for it, considering all the other pressing needs, even outside transportation. But in terms of constructing between city pairs, if states want to do it and the federal government's willing to provide the lowest possible interest rate loan at, you know, whatever the Treasury borrows at plus a couple of basis points, then they're welcome to proceed. And the federal government may provide some money, depending on each year's annual appropriations, how much money's laying around. But in terms of a 90% federal match like the interstate construction had, without a dedicated user revenue source, that's almost impossible to envision.
Well, let me look at the current situation in Washington. President Trump has, in the past, discussed $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan that would do projects like this, supposedly. Could that be a factor here, or do you see this still in the future?
they're still trying to come up with something. But the dirty little secret is that every iteration of this, of these large numbers that you hear from the White House, they include the face value of loans as being part of that, because it's under current law, the government loans don't really cost the federal government that much money as recorded in the deficit. It's a long story, but it is far, far, far easier budgetarily for the federal government to make multi-billion dollar loans than it is to make $100 million of appropriations.
Mm-hmm. You know, between our federal government and our state governments, we are spending $200 billion a year right now on transportation.
Okay.
Flat out grants handed to the states to build mostly roads. So we're not, there's not a shortage of money, and we're already spending big money. We just need to start reallocating what we're spending that money on, what types of transportation we're actually investing in to get the types of benefits we want as a society.
So another listener has sent in a comment on Twitter about how long it will take to be up and running. What will the technology be when it's ready to go?
It's not changing that fast. I mean, these lines usually take up to 10 years to build. The systems just keep getting more tweaked and more refined, and the speeds keep going up. I mean, France started building in 1981. Their first lines were built to 186 miles per hour standards. Now their new lines they're building are 220 mile an hour standards. So the trains can do either. So they just vary the train speeds depending on whether they're on an old line or a new line.
Yeah, steel wheels on steel rails isn't going anywhere. People keep talking about magnetic levitation. You know, maglev has been right around the corner since before I was born. It's the 1960s they were talking about.
Right,
maglev
about
is right around the corner. It's always the technology of the future.
Right. The future that we're never going to see.
Yeah.
Well, we mentioned earlier the line in California, which would connect the major cities there, and there is a 170-mile segment that's under construction. But Governor Gavin Newsom recently, I guess in February, announced that they were putting a halt to the rest of it for now because of cost overruns and how long it was taking. And I guess I'm curious to get your thoughts on how that might impact other rail projects around the country and whether that project is dead.
He actually didn't say we're going to cancel the project. What he said was we're going to focus and concentrate our efforts on the first phase. But then in the same breath, he said, but we're also going to continue working on all of the permitting and all the environmental for the entire 800-mile segment. And then he said, by the time we have the first piece built and all this other pre-clearance work done, there'll be more pots of money show up from the feds, from the state. They have cap and trade money, and they also have private sector interests. So,
but for the time being, he's not going to
focus the project.
For the time being, he's not going to try to find the new money to complete anything beyond Madeira, Merced to Bakersfield. But there are a couple of things about the California project that wouldn't apply anywhere else. They started with the federal government, decided to put that use it or lose it stimulus money, which meant they had to have it all spent, every dime of it, by September 2017, which meant they had to start in the middle, what was supposed to be the cheapest and easiest part, which made the least sense. Fresno to Bakersfield made a lot less sense than starting at San Fran or L.A. if you want a self-contained city pair system that made sense on its own. And Then the federal government never provided more money, and they ran out.
Okay, well, just to remind,
they also are now doing cap and trade in the state, and that's raising hundreds of millions of dollars all the time, and they keep feeding it into the system. So they basically have set up a self-funding. It's a slow process, but it's still moving forward.
So, Andy, you see some optimism for that project. I want to just, before we wrap up here, remind people that there is a public meeting in Charlotte tomorrow night on the proposed Atlanta-Charlotte corridor. And Carol or Casey from Georgia Department of Transportation, what's next for this project after these hearings?
Yeah, this is Casey. So after these hearings, we'll look at everyone's comments that they've provided. We've gotten a ton of comments and feedback so far. GDOT will work, like we said earlier, with North Carolina and South Carolina and the Federal Railroad Administration to choose one of these three corridor alternatives as our preferred. In terms of next steps, that preferred corridor alternative could move forward into a Tier 2 environmental study, but it's just important to remember that funding and a timeline for that next step hasn't been identified yet, but this is a preliminary foundational step to reaching the Tier 2 study.
Okay, and I just want to remind folks, if you want more information about that meeting, you can find it at WFAE.org. Our guests today have been Jeff Davis of the Eno Center for Transportation in Washington, Andy Kuntz, the CEO of the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association, and Carol Comer and Casey Mertz of Georgia Department of Transportation. This is 90.7 WFAE Charlotte Talks. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.